fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the program is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Gail Tverberg, also known as Gail the Actuary. She's a long time in the insurance industry, but she's been writing a lot about peak oil and economics. And anyway, she is our guest. Gail Tverberg, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you. I've been there before, but it's been a little while.
That's right. It has been a while. Well, you've been writing. You keep on writing new articles all the time. And this most recent one, you talk about the oil price gap. So why don't we start out with that?
Yes. Well, I think what the issue is that the price of extracting oil from the ground keeps rising. And that happens because we pull out the cheapest to extract oil first. So what we end up with is more and more expensive oil to pull out of the ground.
Yeah, one way I could think about that is I read that the first oil well in Pennsylvania, they struck oil at 69 feet.
Right, and right. The oil was right close by. It was in Pennsylvania, and some of the later was out in California. But they found maybe some evidence of oily rocks, and they could see that there was oil not very far away, and they could practically dig with a shovel, and they could get the oil out very easily, very cheaply. They didn't have to worry about, you know, foreign governments or anything like that or being deep under the sea. They could get it out really cheap, and they could sell it very cheaply.
Things are different now, though, aren't they?
Right. And so what's happened is that the price of oil keeps going up, and when it does go up, it is possible to get a little more oil out, not very much, but a little bit, and that's what keeps making the newspapers. That's why we keep hearing that there's all of this tight oil out in North Dakota, for example. But, you know, in the whole scheme of things, the amount isn't really all that great, and the reason it's available is because oil prices are so high. It's not, you know, that they're going to bring the price back down again. So, at any rate, this is at least part of the problem, is that the cost keeps going up. But the other flip side of the problem is that the amount people can afford doesn't keep going up. It's not like our salaries are going up. As long as we have to pay more for oil products and all of the things oil makes, it tends to have recessionary effects as the price of oil goes up.
Well, another thing you mentioned besides the cost of extraction is that, you know, these the oil exporters, they are country, they have citizens that, you know, demanding a standard of living. They need jobs and everything else. So these oil exporters have to keep their citizens pacified.
Right, right. You know, the cost of the oil being extracted in those countries isn't necessarily all that high. You know, and some people have said, oh my, they could get it out very cheaply in Saudi Arabia. And I'm not sure that's really true anymore. But, mm-hmm. You know, at least at one point it was very true that you could get it out cheaply in the Middle East. But what happens is as all of this money flows into these countries, the populations have just exploded, And at the same time, the populations, well, these other people generally don't have any work to do because, you know, what is there to do besides drilling oil in these countries? They can't really produce anything else. You can't do farming, for example, and manufacturing isn't really good either. They don't have, you know, wood products. There's a lot of things that they don't have. So they have a lot of unemployed people, and they need to provide, you know, food for these people. They need to find activities for these people, even if they're not really good at finding them jobs. And so what happens is they've figured out ways to absorb the full cost of the oil. You know, as the market price goes up, their costs go up too. And so, you know, there are people who sit down and figure out how much it costs or each of these countries need to support, you know, their current programs. And at this point, there are countries that are really depending on even higher prices than we have right now to keep their programs going.
Well, you mentioned some so what this means then is that if an exporting country can't get a certain price, there's really no then they're going to drop out of the business, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, back when the Soviet Union back in 1991, you know, when it collapsed, it was at a time when the oil prices were low. And they were having difficulty, you know, the big fields that they had been extracting oil from were being exhausted. It wasn't that there wasn't more oil there, but at that price, which was quite low, it didn't make any economic sense to go extract the oil from these other fields. Well, now, you know, and they did collapse, but now they are again exporting. But what happened was once the oil price went up, then they could, in fact, go back and extract oil at the higher prices.
Well, you do mention Russia is one of the countries that they need higher prices than the market right now is providing. You mentioned Nigeria, Venezuela, Iran, Iraq, and Russia. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Right. Well, what happens, you know, in Russia is they've got, well, I guess they're not one whose population has really been growing, but they have to keep extracting more and more difficult to extract oil themselves. So they have quite a bit of costs associated with it. And they have a fairly high population relative to many of these oil exporters. And so, and certainly they have needs of other kinds, such as roads and, you know, other kinds of infrastructure that you normally expect for a country. But what tends to happen in most countries, even the U.S., is that oil extraction is quite highly taxed. And the way these countries keep up their programs is by having, you know, the taxes on the oil extraction. And the more, and it really is, those taxes really are heaviest on the oil that's for export. So that's where they make their money. And, you know, with the prices being flat in the last 3 years or not going up by much, the amount that Russia is getting and these other countries are getting is pretty flat, and it makes it hard to make a go of it.
So will they drop out, take a little breather, or wait for the prices to go up, or what?
Well, it's hard to say what will happen. Usually, you know, like in the Soviet Union situation before, it took a while for things to work through the system. You know, a country can be not doing well financially, and, you know, that doesn't mean that they completely go bankrupt the next year or something falls apart. It takes a little while for it to kind of work through the system.
Mm-hmm.
But they found it increasingly hard to deal with all of the peripheral parts of the former Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union ultimately collapsed in 1991. You know, each of the parts could ended up going out on their own. It becomes too expensive to provide energy to all these pieces, I guess.
Well, I understand that, with all this business in Syria, that the price of oil has been going up. Now, there are actually two kinds of oil they're talking about. There's a Brent crude and there's a West Texas Intermediate, and the Brent oil price is usually higher than the West Texas price, but I think they were talking about the going up to $112 a barrel or higher than that.
Something like that. What happens is that each refinery is configured for a certain kind of crude oil. Well, it's not exactly that way, but certain refineries can handle what we call light sweet crude, and other refineries make their most money if they buy heavy sour crude. They're configured to take what would probably be lower priced crude oil, but then they can apply their magic to it and get products out of it. And what they find is that for them it's most cost effective to buy the heavy sour crude. Well, what happens if you get, for instance, Libya cuts back on its production? It has very much light sweet crude. Well, that light sweet crude went to certain refineries in Europe. Those refineries suddenly find themselves without any oil to buy because there isn't really a nearby, anybody else who can provide the substitute of that particular kind they want.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with problems of that sort. And that's how you get disparities in these prices.
Well, I guess Libya's oil production has really fallen in the last year or so. That's what I've been reading.
Right. They've been having these problems, continual problems or on and off problems anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Fight the Empire, and my guest today is Gail Tverberg, who is a insurance actuary and a longtime writer on peak oil and financial considerations. Well, Gail, tell me about this. Now, we see that there are some, the oil producers, they need a certain price to make it worthwhile. And what about the importers? How do they, how do they decide what they can afford?
Well, I think what happens with importers is it really is more of a situation of where can we make money on something we can sell? If our products that we sell are too expensive for a world market, then we can't sell them. And back in the days when oil was much cheaper, oil and coal were probably not so far apart in the cost. But now, coal is a very cheap fuel. And countries that have developed an economy around coal can tend to produce products a whole lot more cheaply. So what happens, it turns out, is the countries that are most oil-dependent, once the prices are higher, have a hard time competing when the oil price is high. And these are the countries that have been experiencing recession and a cutback in the number of jobs. It's not really that they decide not to import it. It's the fact that the jobs aren't there, and when the jobs aren't there, we don't need the money. We don't need the oil to support the jobs, in terms of using it to produce something or transport something we're making. And also, a young person who doesn't have a job isn't going to buy a car and isn't going to drive it. So that's what reduces the demand. It's kind of a roundabout way. It's more of a recessionary kind of a reaction that we don't necessarily associate with high oil prices, but that's the way it works out. We kind of pull back, when the price is high.
Hmm. Well, then you also mentioned finding newer oil sources, but they are becoming more and more hard to find and hard to reach. And in your article, you have this very interesting chart. It's figure four, and it's a world oil supply with fitted trend lines. And I wish KBOO had a TV station right now that people could see this chart. It shows a kind of the upward thrust of oil supply, and it back in the 60s and 70s is going up quite steeply, and then starting later on it leveled. Every few years it levels off a little bit more. So you have this rising production that keeps leveling off until right now it's it's darn near flat.
Right. And that flatness is when the price is very high. You know, back when we had it shooting up, it was when the prices were very low. You know, back when we could find it cheaply, and we could find lots of it cheaply, and it didn't take much investment to get much more of it out. And my, we got more and more, and, you know, everybody could have a car, and you could change cars every year. You know, they were so cheap. In fact, back when I was growing up, I remember they would change styles practically every year. You know, the tail fins would be different.
Now they do that with smartphones.
right. Now you need a new smartphone. Right. So it's really changed. It's leveled out. And while we hear that, you know, the tight oil out in North Dakota and also in Texas, you know, has been increasing, our increase is being offset by big drops, especially, for example, in the North Sea. And that's one of the places with the very light oil.
Well, this is the thing that people are not aware of, is they talk about all this oil in the ground in North Dakota, you know, but they don't tell you how much it costs, how much energy it takes to get that oil, and so they don't talk about the net gain. And so I think people are getting a kind of a, they're getting misguided here, aren't they?
Well, I think, you know, that's part of the cost that goes up. But I think it's easy to overemphasize. It's just the energy part of it. It's also the fact that we in North Dakota get pretty good taxes on that oil that comes out. And that's part of what keeps the cost up, is because those taxes are necessary. I mean, it helps pay for all of the roads and all of these things that are used when we're pulling the oil out. But sometimes it doesn't even get back to the economies, the local economies whose roads are being ruined, and the other kinds of changes, the fracking and such that is carried on there. So not all the dollars necessarily go back to the right people.
Well, I might say here, this is the environmental costs associated with this kind of oil drilling. We're really not talking about that in this segment, but that is a definite cost. And it's, how do you repair the damage caused by this oil drilling? Or do you, maybe you just let it, leave it go unrepaired? I mean, that's a whole new cost that is not talked about.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy about the fracking. I think that the biggest issues with that are when you're doing it right next door to where somebody lives. Some of the more open spaces, maybe there's less of an issue of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens, it would seem to me that there's this big gap between what the exporters require and what the importers can afford. And doesn't that mean that some people are already being priced out of the market? Maybe not in the United States so much, but other parts of the world? Or is that so?
Well, I think the people who are being priced out of the market are young people today, for example.
Mm.
They're the ones who don't have jobs. You know, the big thing that happens when you have high oil prices is you don't have enough good-paying jobs. And so it's a kind of a connection through that direction. And so people who have jobs stay home and play their video games, or maybe they take another college course or two, hoping that when they finally finish, they can find something doing, you know, earning more than minimum wage.
Well, eventually this all catches up, I would think.
Right. Well, what happens, too, is then these people live at home with their parents indefinitely, mm-hmm. and so they're not out buying a new house, besides not buying a new car. And so then they wonder why the economy is kind of listless as it kind of stumbles along.
Well, this is sort of how these economies shrink to fit the situation. What happens if the oil prices continue staying high? And you have this, I just read this article in today's paper about this G20 summit, and one of the problems they're talking about is just lagging growth all around the world.
Right. Well, what happens is the growth stays low, and part of what governments try to do to keep growth going as well as they can is they try to keep very low interest rates, like mm-hmm. you've been seeing on your houses and on your car loans. Well, what happens, though, is if something goes wrong and those interest rates start going up, or I guess the other thing that can go wrong is the amount of government debt can go through the ceiling. And, you know, that's, we're talking about hitting the debt ceiling again in October on that. And so what happens is if one of those things goes wrong is then these things are really being used to keep the economy pumped up to what extent it can. But if the interest rates go up, then it becomes harder to buy new houses, harder to buy new cars. And so then we get a big step down in the economy again as the interest rate situation goes back to what we would think of as more of a normal situation. And, well, of course, if we have the government hit the debt ceiling, we end up with a whole lot more layoffs in the government sector, and that causes problems too.
Yeah, I think recently when there was talk about easing up on this quantitative whatever, that the stock market reacted very badly. But I read one economics writer is claiming that if the yield on treasury bonds hits a certain level, that all sorts of terrible things will happen. That there's, he talks about a $440 trillion derivatives bubble. Can you explain that at all?
Well, I'm not sure if I can exactly explain the $440 trillion in derivative bubble, but so many things are all tied together here. And so, and people have been betting one way or another on what interest rates are going to do, and I suppose the derivative bubble is one of the things that could be affected. But we really have had a long-term decline in interest rates since, I believe, it's about 1981. Well, that long-term decline in interest rates is part of what's pumped up the stock markets over the years. You start going the other direction, and then you suddenly hit extreme winds going the opposite direction. But if you have derivative bubbles, you could have some big banks finding themselves in the same situation as 2008, or worse, a whole lot worse.
Can you go into any more detail than that? I mean, like what would happen?
Well, I'm sure that, you know, one side is guaranteed that the price will go one direction while the other wants it to go the other direction, and they may have a big payoff.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if there are any kind of quick changes, you can suddenly have the situation that AIG was in back at the time that it had to be bailed out.
Well, you know, this derivatives bubble, I don't quite understand what it is. It sounds to me like the sum total of a whole lot of gambling bets, but if there is an awful lot of debt that's out there, and I know the, you know, you have these two competing schools of economics. You have the Keynesians and you have the Austrians, and they, you know, they got different prescriptions, but they claim that if you follow our way, growth will increase. But what if growth doesn't increase? I mean, you got to, how do these debts get paid off? What happens then?
Well, as far as what I can see is that if you have a fast enough economic growth rate, then you can pay back a decent interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
But as the interest, as the growth rate goes down, it becomes lower, then it becomes harder and harder to pay back the interest on the debt. And as the growth gets stalled out, it becomes more and more of a problem. And, you know, part of what is keeping up the oil drilling, say, in North Dakota, is this the availability of cheap loans to support those who are doing the drilling out there. So if you start getting the oil extraction to go down, you could actually have the economy shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got the economy shrinking, then you've really got a lot of debt defaults on your hand, most likely.
Now, these could be all sorts of defaults. I mean, when you talk about this accumulated debt, it would include, you know, just, you know, the money that a person owes to the, on his mortgage or his credit card bill, or it could be what the cities and states owe to the banks for bonds that they floated. It could be include all this stuff. What happens, say you start getting these defaults, do they kind of, do they pile up and cascade, or what happens to them?
Well, you would think that that's what would happen, as you know, you've got everything from student loans that people are going to pay
mm-hmm.
back because they don't have a job. You have the people who default on their home loans. And, of course, the banks then are depending on these loans, and the insurance companies have these on their balance sheets and as well. So then you end up with banks that need to be bailed out and insurance companies that need to be bailed out.
But we got no money to bail them out with.
It would actually print more money, but, you know, what do you, you can print it, but you have to have the oil to actually make these products that you're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so that becomes a problem, too, oil and gas. And you know that you can't substitute anything other than oil for in the car you drive. You know, it's pretty much determined, you know, whether you use regular or premium gas. You can't just drive up and get natural gas tomorrow in your car.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of stuck with a particular kind. So we can talk about, you know, what might in theory happen 10 years from now, but, you know, the real world is we really need the oil.
Well, it'd be kind of hard to, you know, we used to have trains that ran on coal. They have a guy who's shoveling coal into the boiler all the time. You can't do that on an airplane or a car. But I just wondering, would, you know, we should see, well, I hear my theme music playing, but we should think ahead to where this will all end, because if the if we have this debt and no growth, what happens? Can you give us a quick look ahead?
Well, I'm afraid you get some sort of collapse situation if you can't make things work out.
Wow. Well, we've been talking to Gail Fairberg, who is an insurance actuary and an economics and a peak oil writer. You have a website. Can you tell us about that real quickly?
I write on a site called Our Finite World. That's OurFiniteWorld.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I write there fairly regularly. And you can follow me on Gail the Actuary on Twitter.
Okay. We've been talking with Gail the Actuary herself. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good talking to you.
And stay tuned for KBOO, Always Something Good.
Well, good morning. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. It is just a minute now before 10 o'clock. Coming up at 10:15, hear Flashpoints. Today, guest host Kevin Pina speaks with organizers uniting against military action in Syria, including Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, and Kevin examines the continuing human rights crisis in Egypt. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Leanne Krantz welcomes Oregon author and creative writing teacher Stephen Allred to discuss his debut linked short story collection, A Simplified Map of the Real World. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, hosts Patricia Welch, O.B. Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford speak with Denorja Taylor, who writes science fiction for all ages and all kinds of people. But next, it is Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And that is coming up next on KBOO.
The KBOO Board of Directors elections are underway. KBOO members can vote for up to 4 candidates. Ballots were mailed in mid-August. If you think you are a KBOO member and have not received a ballot, email membership director Andrew Geller at membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Non-members can join KBOO and receive a ballot to vote. Just go to kboo.fm and click donate on the top right-hand corner. The annual meeting is Sunday, September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Community Center at 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. You can mail back your ballot or bring it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Ballots must be postmarked by September 10th or cast at the annual meeting by 2:40 p.m. to count. Get informed, get involved, and vote. Thanks.